Welcome. Thank you all so much for coming. It's a very nice group tonight. My name's Candace Agree. Some of you may know me from WQXR, where I host a weekend evening program. Just imagine what the applause will build, believe you me, and not for me. I just wanted to let you know how this symposium on Carlos Serignac and the creation of modern dance came about. About a year ago, Anthony Pizar, who is the director of the Foundation for Iberian Music here, said, "What would you think about a program on Carlos Serignac?" And I said, "It would be a great idea. Not much is known about him. Not much is written about him. At WQXR, we play some of his arrangements of the Albanese Iberia, which he orchestrated. And I thought that there would be a very particular type of person who followed dance in the pretty much in the 50s and 60s who would know him, but a whole younger generation, myself included, may I, would love to be introduced to his music and his dance. And he is such a unique personality, and for some reason, which I hope we'll get into, we'll try to discover why his music has been overlooked. We will talk a little bit with the panel, who I'll introduce in just a moment, and we have the opportunity to see on film Embattled Garden in a performance made in 2003, thank you, at Jacob's Pillow?
Yeah.
And that is thanks to Aaron Sherber, who is on my right, who is the music director of the Martha Graham Company. And we have a unique opportunity to not only see the dance, because it's kind of ridiculous to talk about dance and not see it, but also to hear the chamber work as well. When we picked the date for this conference and concert, it was really only by chance that we noticed afterwards that we're mark two anniversaries. One is the death of Martha Graham, which was April 1st, of 1991, and the 50th anniversary of the premiere of Embattled Garden, which was at the Adelphi Theater on April 3rd, 1958, so this week as well. Now to introduce the panel, Anthony Pizar at the far right is the director for the Foundation for Iberian Music, which is part of the Barry S. Brooks Center for Music Research and Documentation at the CUNY Graduate Center. He teaches music history at CUNY, as well as at Hofstra, John Jay, and other colleges, and he's written books on a number of important musicians of Europe and the Americas. To his left is Ninochka Benahoum, who is a dance historian and choreographer, and also she is an associate professor at Long Island University's Brooklyn campus, where she directs the Master of Fine Arts program in New Media Art and Performance, as well as LIU at American Ballet Theater, a bachelor's degree program for American Ballet Theater dancers. She's taught history of dance at Swarthmore and Princeton and published numerous articles and reviews on dance. And her work first came to my attention in 2001 when I became aware of this marvelous book, Antonia Mercé, La Argentina, Flamenco and the Spanish Avant-Garde, which is published by Wesleyan University Press.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. It's a pleasure. To Ninochka's left is Aaron Sherber, who has been the music director and conductor of the Martha Graham Dance Company since 1998. He's prepared new editions of several pieces written for Martha Graham, which are featured regularly in the Graham Company's performances. He's been a guest conductor with the Boston Conservatory and England's Birmingham Royal Ballet. He was also the music director of Opera Vivente, a company specializing in innovative productions of chamber opera, and he is on the faculty of the Peabody Institute. To my left is a woman who needs no introduction, but I will anyway. None of these panelists do. Carmen de Lavallade is a name well known to anyone who has even the most casual acquaintance with dance, theater, or film. A premier dancer in the Metropolitan Opera's productions of Samson and Delilah and Aida, she later choreographed Met productions of Porgy and Bess and Meister Singer, and she's brought to life the choreography of Lester Horton, John Butler, of course, Jeffrey Holder, Alvin Ailey, and many others. She has awards for her Shakespeare roles, numerous appearances in film, honorary doctorates. It's really just too numerous to mention. In short, she's been described as a beautiful, brilliant, and unique woman by none other than Stuart Hode, who is at the far left here. Now, he began studying at the Martha Graham School soon after his discharge from the U.S. Army Air Corps, in which he'd served as a bomber pilot in World War II, and as a member of the Graham Company, he toured the U.S., Europe, and Asia, becoming one of Martha Graham's partners. He's performed in Broadway musicals, nightclubs, on television. He's gone swimming with Esther Williams and toured the U.S. doing two-person musical shows with his wife, Elizabeth Hodes, and he's taught at the Martha Graham School, was director of the Martha Graham School, in fact. He's the author of A Map of Making Dances, a book on the art of choreography, and he's the editor and publisher of ChorusGypsy.com, which is a webzine, fascinating webzine, which features human interest stories about life backstage. And that is our panel. So to begin, I think that in your programs you have some good information about Carlos Sorignac. A few points I just wanted to bring out, and then we can begin our discussion. He was a Spaniard, a Catalan, whose music is filled with the rhythms of Andalusian flamenco. He was admired by a great many choreographers, yet he would only discuss or give an opinion on the work of Martha Graham. And we'll find out why. He's remembered as having a spicy and expansive personality, an extremely dry wit, yet seems to have been deeply private about his personal life, even about his childhood years and the family dynamics of growing up. He was a generous and willing collaborator, but insisted on approval for any modifications or adaptations of his work. He felt orchestrating another composer's work was more difficult than composing, than creating an original composition. His old world manners and courtesy were often misinterpreted as snobism. In fact, he never disparaged jazz or loud rock and roll. What he couldn't stand was pretentious, noisy, serious music. So it's really been fascinating to learn a little bit about the dichotomy of this very rich personality. One of the most interesting things I read about him was this quote: "I have always thought that the composer must always serve the stage." And that is not music by Sorignac, by the way. And I wanted to, I guess, just throw this out to anybody, but I was thinking of Ninotchka because of the book. If we could talk a little bit about the appeal of Spanish music in America and about Sorignac's predecessors, about the Spanish school of or how he's continuing the line of, let's say, Falla and Turina, Granados.
Well, I come to this through a long study of Manuel de Falla's composition, L'amour sorcier, Amor brujo, which La Argentina danced after Pastora Imperio. It was begun in 1915, and then it came to America in 1928 and toured here quite widely. And what's wonderful about having this conference in New York is that you already have a love of Hispanic musical dance culture. Sorignac, clearly, by 1947, when he's finished in Barcelona and he becomes the conductor at the Liceo, where there's quite a bit of nightclub work and quite a bit of symphonic orchestral performance, in fact, there are even movies, etc., is most definitely the inheritor of this Hispanic modernist tradition, which for Albaynis and Granados and others is a neo-national, neo-primitivist search for folklore, for identity. For Manuel de Falla, it's an avant-garde search, almost an ethnographic look an intellectual look at how flamenco rhythms, compás, which you'll see in Ritmo Hondo, you'll hear in Ritmo Hondo, could become the object itself, could become the work of modern art itself. So it wasn't just a kind of performing tourism. Let's go look at the gypsies dance in Andalusia, and as Stravinsky does in Serbia, as Dvorak will do, you know, as Albéniz does with these multiple sort of emotional colorings for Iberia. But rather, it's a real study with García Lorca, his great friend, of cante hondo and of 12 count measures, of frenzied rhythms, of complicated footwork, of the actual art form in its spirituality, if you will. And Doris Humphrey has this fantastic way in her genius study in Ritmo Hondo of channeling that, of bringing it to another, I guess, choreographic moment. And Serignac serves that almost as a median. It's as if there's a seance moving through his score to us who have always taken in, I guess, the refugees and the artists of the Spanish Civil War. Serignac, of course, was not part of that. He was already in Paris by 1950, but when he comes in 1950, he brings that tradition, and great, and we're so lucky that the Baroness de Rothschild brings him to Doris Humphrey, brings him to Martha Graham, and says, this is something for us. This is a place of modern art. This is a place of abstract expression. Can you help shape it, basically? And it's the Baroness de Rothschild we thank for these introductions to these great choreographers. So I said a little
that was,
of...
That was fantastic. And was she a student of the Graham, or just a...
She was the patron of Martha Graham and Doris Humphrey. She introduces Serignac. Serignac, of course, probably in Katie, thank you to Katie Matheson in her oral interview of Serignac, you see that Serignac is quite a character. He only answers the questions he wants to answer, right? You've said that. Although he's clearly fluent in French, but he certainly doesn't know English very well when he comes here. But still, you feel a very strong personality, committed to not only giving music to choreographers, which is quite unusual for composers, but also to giving Spanish, Hispanic, and in the tradition of Manuel de Falla, Hispano-Arab, Sephardic, you know, chants, saeta, bulerías, etc., to the tradition. So does that answer your...
Yes, I think very well. And how, and you both, Stuart Hodes and Carmen de Lavalade, worked with Carlos Serignac, and how did you find these dances, as far as with the John Butler Company? How did Serignac bring forward these aspects of flamenco, and how were they interpreted? What was the collaboration like? Is it the Martha Graham collaboration, the John Butler collaboration?
Well, the piece that Carlos did for John Butler. John Butler the choreographer John Butler had a wonderful way of gathering the most extraordinary people for his choreographies and his costuming, and he knew everybody. And I think he and Carlos and Peggy Granville Hicks were his favorite composers. And we were doing these early morning Look Up and Live and Lamp Unto My Feet biblical stories on either, I think it was NBC.
It was on CBS.
They were wonderful programs. And we did David and Bathsheba. And I remember that Carlos would come to every rehearsal. And I think it was between him and John. They I think he composed that especially for us.
I think you're right.
And so it meant that John would choreograph movement, and then Carlos would come in, and there was, you know, this guy. But he was always wonderful and very sweet. He's lovely, and he used to call me Chameleon. I was the Chameleon. And but it was interesting to see them work, and I always find it fascinating when composers come in and the dance is not done yet. It's done in silence, you know, and then they come in and they look at it, and then there's connection between the choreographer and the composer, and they seemed to get along quite well. But it was always a pleasure when he came in, You know, was it the same way with you? Or was it?
No, it was the same. but Martha had different ways. I mean, it depending on the composer. Unfortunately, I was not in this dance. It was the first dance that was created after I left the company. but we know how some of the dances were formed. She and Aaron Copland had an extensive correspondence. I was there when she was working to. We're doing a diversion of Angels, and the composer would send over a page of music. That was
Delajoie,
Norman Delajoie. He would send over a page of music, and Helen Lanfer would play it, and she'd choreograph it. The next day, we'd get another page or two pages, and then she'd go back sometimes and throw everything out and go on. So in that case, she was following the music. In the case of, it was a detective story, but she had wanted to do it. I wish I had these things on the tip of my mind, but for instance, when she did the Hindemith piece.
Herodiad.
Say it?
Herodiad.
Herodiad. She didn't submit that to him. She had asked a score from the Mexican composer.
Carlos Chavez.
Chavez. You probably know this story, too.
I'll be your alternate brain.
Yeah, thank you. And he never showed up with a score, and it was a different subject. And she sent it to him, and he sent back, he said, I'll do a different score. And he suggested the music and sent it. So she started with this score, took his idea. I mean, I know many people who would have been a little affronted.
Well, I mean, I think that's, we're getting off on a little bit of a tangent here.
I know, we're getting off the track, but I'm trying
With Herodiad, yes, it did start out as originally Chavez was one of the commissioners, was part of the Appalachian Spring commissioning set. But the idea for Herodiad was something that Graham and Hindemith agreed on between themselves. And I think even in the case when we get to Embattled Garden, some of these later things, it still is Graham coming up with...
I don't know how Embattled Garden worked.
Okay.
Which one of those was the way it... was there a whole new way?
Her main way of working from the 40s, probably up into the 70s, was to create at least a scenario and a description
scenario,
of what she wanted for the dance.
Now, I can tell you, I was there when a very interesting thing happened. When Rita Mahondo was premiered, the whole Graham Company went, and Martha was there. And
now, you mean premiered at the chamber work at MoMA?
Yeah.
At the percussion concert?
No.
Not the dance.
I'm talking about the dance.
You're talking about the dance.
Yeah.
Okay.
And, you know, I can't remember the theater. It was too big a dance to be done at the Y. It might have been Needle Trays. I don't know. I'm sure some of you know. But I think that's not relevant. We were all in the audience, and everybody says Martha and Doris were big rivals. But Martha never expressed that to us. She never talked against Doris, ever, to me or in my hearing. And so in her own biography, she says, I suppose we were rivals, if any of you remember that. But at that, we felt rivalrous in the company. When we met the, when we met the dancers, we loved them. But before then, we had seen this dance, and were terribly impressed, Rita Mahondo, if any of you have seen it. The music was knockout. The dancers danced like demons. But it had a strange ending. Well, not strange. The women have been ravished, abandoned, and the men rush off stage, leaving them on their knees, their hair streaming down, these poor, pathetic creatures. Martha didn't like that. And she said the next day, quote, that is not the deep rhythm between women and men. So anyway, but she made no secret of her absolute love of that music, and very soon after that, we began feeling that he was part of the empire around her of composers, and that's it.
And in battle, it's interesting to talk this way about sort of working methods for a couple of reasons. First of all, Embattled Garden was a little different among... Graham commissioned a large number, some six dozen scores over the course of her career. She commissioned Cernak four times and used his music a fifth time, a non-commissioned piece. But Embattled Garden, she was aware of his music before she commissioned and actually had heard a set of three pieces, the Tientos, for I think it's harp and harpsichord and piano and timpani and English horn. Yeah. She had heard those pieces, and part of the request for the commission for Embattled Garden was to incorporate those three pieces into the score. And in the orchestral score, those are three distinct episodes, and they're labeled as the three tantos. And one of the things that's very interesting about Embattled Garden is how seamlessly that's all woven together into something much larger and something very different. And I think what's very interesting about Cyrenaic's music, and this gets back to something that you were saying earlier, the quote you read about the composers serving the stage. I mean, that was very much the aesthetic of Graham, had been for 20 years already. And it's always interesting to find composers who really share that aesthetic. And I think that gets back again to something else you were saying, one reason why a good chunk of his music may not be that well known. The composer who takes it as his mission to write for dance, and many of Cyrenaic's compositions were for dance, you're serving another art. You're not in the spotlight. It's almost a self-negating kind of art form. Mm-hmm. And the music is wonderful and fits the dance wonderfully and is very rhythmic, which gives dancers the kinds of things they need, is very danceable kind of music. But I was struck, I was just listening to Owl and the Pussycat a couple days ago, one of the last commission, the last commission score by Cyrenaic for Graham. And I was thinking about when Aaron Copland wrote Appalachian Spring and then made an orchestral and chamber suite out of it, which is what most people know, the suite, he wrote a little note to the score. Well, this mostly follows the ballet, but I've taken out the bits that are primarily of choreographic interest. And if you compare the scores, he's taken out things where there's, instead of eight repeats of a phrase, he'll give you two repeats, because the other repeats only make sense if it's being danced. And I was thinking about Owl and the Pussycat, thinking, boy, if Copland were doing that to this score, he'd take out most of the score. It's a wonderful score, and it's great to see these pieces, but you sit there and listen to it, and there's almost nothing there. It's so much in service to what the greater work will be, to what the choreographer wants. Yes.
I think that actually one of Cyrenaic's part of his criteria for writing was that if you're noticing the orchestra and you're listening to the music and not watching the dance, it's not a successful composition.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, actually, and there's a wonderful quote. Aaron Copland said something very much the same thing, that if you're someone who writes for the stage has to realize that he's not the main event,
right,
that he's got to get out of the way of what's going on. And that was exactly the aesthetic that Graham liked in her composers. I think that's one reason that collaboration worked well.
But yet a lot of his scores for the dance end up being used by other choreographers and not written specifically for them, which I think is very interesting. And he said all of his music is dance music.
Yeah. Well, that's why the dancers love it. They just hear something and they said, and immediately they'll get their juices going, because it's a good piece of music. It's a wonderful, exciting piece of music. And so half the time, they wouldn't know what other company had danced it. They just heard that wonderful sound. That doesn't make any difference that somebody else did it.
Right.
A choreographer named Frank Bove, who runs the Virginia Ballet, five years ago, he said, I love the music of Appalachian Spring, and I've never seen the dance. Do you think it would be legitimate for me to make a dance? So I said, why not? Of course. And he did, and he sent me a video of it. It was nice. It was totally abstract. It had nothing to do with Martha's idea. It was just, he heard the music, and he made up trios and duets and solos and pas de deux, and it worked fine. I mean, I don't think it was Appalachian Spring. But what's the difference?
Now, when was it Alvin Ailey who decided to use the music for Ritmo Hondo? He had for Feast of Ashes, and with that, and also with Doppio.
Was it Ritmo
Doppio Hondo? Concerto?
I saw Feast of Ashes.
Yeah.
It was a powerful dance. I don't remember.
Do you know if he'd seen it? If he'd seen that dance first, or whether he just liked the music?
He probably just liked the music.
Yeah.
And Cyrenaic didn't have any problem about writing bridges or combining different parts of his other works, because I...
Do you know about that?
No, I don't.
My guess is he wouldn't.
Yeah.
Because he was an easy guy.
Yeah, I know that when he and John were, it was easy going. I mean, they would discuss things, and it was this, can you change this, can we do this? Because he, like you said, he was adjusting to the dance.
Right.
Well, and there's a very practical, that aspect of practicality again, in The Owl and the Pussycat, Cernak actually prepared two different orchestrations for Graham to use. One was a slightly larger orchestra that included, this piece was written in 1978, it was a commission, actually Graham's last commission score. The larger orchestration used an instrument called the clavinet, which is it's a kind of electric clavichord that was vaguely popular in the 70s. There's not an awful lot of it going around nowadays. But he also prepared a second, slightly smaller orchestration without the clavinet. I think he realized there wouldn't always be clavinets around that you could perform this piece with. And in fact, when we did the piece a couple years ago, we weren't about to go find a clavinet player, so we used the other orchestration. But that speaks to a certain practicality in what he was doing.
I don't know if it's relevant, and stop me if it isn't, but from the very first lessons I took with Martha, she was always using Spanish as a kind of... the word Spanish as a way to get us to dance in a certain way, you know, to stand up, to be strong. And one day we were all sitting on the floor while she was, oh, and it had nothing to do with the Spanish piece. It was it was Letter to the World, and it was my first piece, and we were the anonymous people that come in and just are kicked out later when the men are banished. But we were supposed to be steely strong, and she kept giving us Spanish images, and she said, if you do not bear arrogance, she used the word arrogance, she said, if you do not bear your arrogance from within, your costume will not give it to you. And I remember, that is a quote, and I remember turning to Mark Ryder. We'd both been Army veterans, and we had an Army expression, and I whispered it to him. I said, poker assed. And Martha said, what? And I repeated it, and she said, exactly. So whenever the step draw is a certain step, you know the step draw. Always okay. You had to be Spanish. So I think she loved the power, just the sheer steely power. When Louis Horst taught us the gavotte, not the gavotte, the pavane, he brought that out again and spoke of the culture that that Martha was always wanting to capture in her dances.
Well, we talked a little bit about Embattled Garden, and we have the opportunity, thanks to the Martha Graham Dance Company, to see this film. And if anybody wants to say anything about this idea of the Spanishness of it, or the flamenco aspect, or a modern aspect, or even a pure music aspect of it. Are there any particular comments?
Sorignac is very complicated, and it probably would be too detailed here, but the Saeta, he goes in and out of using very specific gypsy music, not giving you the impression of it, but actually using it, which is what Faya did. The Saeta, they say, is a Sephardic chant that's left over from the Inquisition. It's a processional, so much of the timpani, much of the brass that he uses actually is sort of bearing homage to that. And yet it then goes, ay, 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 I'm not a cantaora, but, you know, then it goes into this huge improvisational solo, which he then leaves out, but choreographers, interestingly enough, pick up on rhythmically and place in the feet. So it's as if these Graham and Humphrey are creating other musical scores, as if they're communing with Sorignac, who's communing with flamenco gypsy artists. There's another, which you'll see hints of 12-count phrases. They're very complicated. Not the actual, there are a few 12-count phrases. The rest are the idea of the 12-count phrase, but like it, with much African influence in flamenco, you'll see it'll be in twos and in threes. So the rhythm is very complicated and very hard to dance. And what's wonderful is how wonderfully these dancers are able to execute these movements and carry the technical phrasing of Graham, the technical phrasing of John Butler, Alvin Ailey, Paul Taylor, Doris Humphrey. And that's what's extraordinary, is it's built these wonderful dancing bodies who become Spanish-American dancing bodies. And that's, I think, a great gift Sérignac gives us.
Yeah, well, Sérignac had said that he thought that the dancers today, or the dancers of his day, could really dance anything. He thought that the dancers in the American-trained dancers could dance anything. And I'm just curious, can the musicians play everything? Pretty much. That's good. Just a quick question about, since we're talking about Embattled Garden, which we'll also hear, and we'll also hear Ritmo Hondo, if anyone cared to talk a little bit about that tradition of the Cante Hondo, and especially the use of the hand clappers.
Of what?
The palmas.
We actually saw a moment of that. At the Tudor Centennial, there is a time. It was in the Limón piece. That was fascinating.
That was beautiful.
And I wondered if these were post-Spanish Civil War memories that choreographers were picking up on, or if it was a rhythmic frenzy that New York Carmen de Lavalade was discussing, how from Cuba we had these incredible rhythms in the 50s, and Sérignac was certainly channeling them. But palmas bring you multiple rhythmic lines, multiple polyrhythmic lines, and make it very hard, actually, for dancers to get through a series of movements with lyricism. And I was thinking about how you rehearsed these pieces. They must have been really hard rhythmically, no?
No. rhythmically hard is that if your ear is trained, you know, and you're used to all kinds of music. I mean, I was exposed to all kinds of music from the Caribbean, from Africa, you know, concert, everything. And I'm a fiend for music anyway, and my ears go right to it, and I memorize everything, and I have a feel for it. And so to me, it just made me feel better. And I can hear, and I'm not one of those every note person. And I like to hear things that go in and out, and I can hear things over and under, and I like to sometimes go against it and play with it. I like to play with the music. And even though John or whomever the choreographer is, yes, I stay on I know the steps, but I like to smudge it a little bit and play with the orchestra. And play with the composer, because that's what I feel music is. It's not all, you know, stiff, and it's got different colors. You have to color things, and it can't be the same. And that's what I love about Spanish music, you know, and those wonderful rhythms. They're just extremely exciting. But I find most dancers, because your ear is trained, you know, no matter what is given you, you have to really pick up on the music, and it doesn't matter what kind of music it is. Say, when you get Stravinsky, and you try and count that. You ask people about, you know, the Sacre du Printemps, you have nightmares at night about that. But you do it. But your ear picks up. Sometimes you don't have to count. If you really listen to it, you don't have to count it.
Nah. Wasn't there a score? I seem to remember Slonimsky had prepared a score for, I don't want to say who, where he redid the measures for The Rite of Spring.
Rite of Spring, there are a couple different...
Was it for the conductors?
It was for the conductor. Rite of Spring is tough for the conductors, too.
Oh, really?
But, it's very true that dancers often have a very different way of counting music than musicians do.
Drives musicians crazy.
I'm amazed how you can count virtually anything in 4-4, and it comes out okay at the end, but I'm not quite sure.
You find a way.
I was dance captain a lot of shows. I had to know everything and make sure everybody else knew it. And I kept 3 sets of counts. Because some dancers counted everything in eights.
That's right.
Some count measures, and some counted some other way. So,
Okay,
well, musicians never were very making a... They weren't complimentary when they used the term dancers counts.
No.
Oh, they're not.
Okay, be careful.
Throw them crazy.
Yeah. So why don't we take a look at Embattled Garden? And I was also very interested to find out that when Martha Graham asked him to do the score and explain the story to him, he had never, in Spain, he'd never come across this idea of Lilith at all. That was a new element for him. That Adam was, you know, under previous management, let's say. So, he said it wasn't in his Spanish Bible. was part of it. Yeah, I thought that was interesting.
You kept using may I set
the word,
this up?
Sephardic. Was he Jewish?
Sirignac.
No.
Oh no, I don't think so.
Well, so why did you use?
The Sephardic chants of the Saeta, because he uses the Saeta. But many, many composers, Garcia Lorca and Manuel de Falla use the word Sephardic or Jewish chant. They're clear about that. But I haven't read anything that Sirignac said about that. But knowing Falla, going to Barcelona Conservatory.
Well, there's a new
it becomes part of the Spanish tradition.
Yeah.
I mean, it's
Goliath.
Oh, yes, it's called Goliath.
I love his music.
Yeah,
I mean, I get the same, not the same, he's so different.
Yeah.
But what there is about, to me anyway, about Sirignac is this drive, this fierceness, just sends you off.
I was going to say it's very energetic music, and in a lot of ways it is. It's interesting because certainly of the scores he wrote for Graham, Embattled Garden has some wonderful lyrical sections. And actually, Al and the Pussycat, too, that little lullaby at the end, just some gorgeous, gorgeous music. So, but it alternates between that very powerful. I was thinking what Stuart was saying about that the Spanish thing that Martha Graham was trying to get out, and the flamenco influences and so forth, and then just some very tender lyricism. You hear both of that in Embattled Garden.
Any more comments before we view it about the piece? Are you conducting this performance?
No, I'm not. But I was. Would you like me to set this up?
Yes,
a little bit,
please.
Okay.
Please.
So, Embattled Garden was the first of the four scores that Graham commissioned from Sirignac. It was premiered, as Candace said, 50 years ago in 1958. It's Adam and Eve and the serpent, whom Graham called the stranger, and Adam's supposed first wife, Lilith. And the quickest synopsis of this is Adam and Eve and Bob and Carol and Ted and Alice. it's a very, I don't want to say lighthearted, but it's certainly not a serious piece, a sort of idea of what might have transpired in a very lush and Spanish garden almost. And you'll see Isamu Noguchi, who did the set for this, did a lot of Graham sets, gives this wonderful, almost day-glow jungle-slash-garden set that works wonderfully. Lilith starts out fanning herself at the beginning of this, and there's a lot of that Spanish kind of influence, a lot of the things that Stuart was talking about in terms of the movement. But it's about the temptation of both Adam and Eve.
Wanted to quote Sirignac from this interview. Graham built a contemporary Eden because she couldn't find in the established Bible the female characters she wanted, so she went to the Talmud for the Lilith who lives at the base of a tree and brings Adam. Actually, she teaches Eve how to make love to Adam.
Okay. Well, I mean, well, there's so many
that.
Interpretations. You
yeah.
go on forever. To me, Lilith is the devil in the female aspect. And when I saw that dance, of course, it knocked me out and made me think, why did I leave the Graham Company? But but it's another version. Instead of, you know, the devil saying, come into my, you know, being tempted, you know.
What I
he
heard.
Just said, the hell with this, and he raped Eve and threw her back and said, let's see what you make of that. I mean, it was just, see if you can come together again.
No, Lilith wanted to
did.
Be boss.
What?
Lilith wanted to be boss. And she was... And Adam didn't like it, and she said, "Well, she
you
left."
Dance, Lilith?
No,
you should.
Okay, well, let's see what you think.
She had a different attitude about it.
Okay, we'll get out of the way.